so happy to be here. This is an incredible honor for me. It's always, Milford and I have known each other for about 23 years. I did a little math the other day. And I've had the incredible fortune to spend time at his home with him and learn from him. And I consider every moment I get to spend with him a great honor and a real privilege. So this conversation included. I appreciate people coming out today. I was really sick a couple weeks ago when we were supposed to do this first round, and so I appreciate it.
People thought I was sick. No. They seemed to be hopping around the place. Nobody wanted to say that. I was wondering if you were okay. That's not me. I was not sick.
It was all me. Yeah. I was sick for two of us, actually. But I couldn't make it out, so I'm really doubly glad to be here today. On the off bizarre chance that there's anybody here who really doesn't know what Milford Graves sounds like when he plays, I'm going to play a little bit of recording from 1973 that is on YouTube. I selected a section of it that's Milford solo. And so I'm just going to play this for a little bit, and then we'll go from there. Thank you.
You know, this is 2018, and that was 1973.
Damn.
You have to go all the way back and say,
I mean, if you are a person who follows a lot of drumming, you've never seen anybody do that. You've never seen anybody do that. Nobody else except Milford has ever done that. And that's a thing that's absolutely true. And so I want to talk a little bit, about the beginnings of you getting involved in playing drums, but I'd like to start, I know you, when you were a kid, you banged around on pots and pans, and right. But I want to ask you a little bit about, particularly about getting involved in Latin music.
Okay, you know, the first thing I would have to say is that in the boxing world, Muhammad Ali used to come out and say, "I'm the greatest." And then we have in the basketball world today, LeBron James will come out and say, "I'm the greatest basketball player ever." I don't like that kind of talk. I've heard people say certain things about me, and it was very inspirational at that concert. Two people said something to me. One guy said, "You don't play jazz, you don't play Indian, you don't play this, you don't play that." He said, "You play it all." And this guy had a radio program. And there was a gentleman came in, a real old guy, man. And he said, he was a drummer, but an old guy, he said, "I've seen everybody." He said, "But you the greatest, man." And I could have took that and went around and said, "Well, I'm the greatest and greatest that." I said, "You know, I do what I do. You know, I don't like this number one, number two, and all of this here." They said, I had discussion with them. I said, "Everybody does what they do, especially if it's in the so-called jazz world. They got everybody so cloned now. Everybody's doing licks and following this and following that. Where I came up, you know, we all had this kind of individual expression, this kind of thing we had. And it's like two people having a conversation. It's that we have this thing back and forth. You know, so I will never say, and the people who've been around me, they have never heard me say I'm the greatest or the top or a number one drummer. But people, which I won't say names, but I said, "That's great, you know." And there's drummers around me that didn't say nothing for years. And what they'll say now, though, they say, "Nobody plays like you." I said, "I think so, but maybe nobody plays like you." You know, it's according to what you want to do. All I want to do, my main thing on that instrument is specifically for drummers, is to liberate the drummer from playing a subordinate role and being more of an integral part of the band or the ensemble. It's simple. You know, don't reduce me to some timekeeper, you know, just holding you up all the time. And, you know, so that's my stance on that. Because there's drummers in the room today, you will never hear me say, you know, "You can't play a blah, blah, blah." I'll ask you, "What do you want to do?" If you say, "I want to do this and I want to do that," then I'll say, "I'm sorry, but you're not doing what you say." But if you're doing what you're talking about, then I say, "Fine. I try to do what I want to talk about." So, to my left, right? Okay.
Well, so to go to the Latin question,
yeah.
What's interesting to me about the idea of starting to play Latin music vis-a-vis what it gave you, or it provided you with a particular point of view coming into playing so-called free music or creative music or jazz, at a certain point where, if we think about the snare drum as being one of the central points of the kit for a timekeeping drummer, the snare is there to help keep that time as regularly and as swingingly as needed. What you did was to instead turn it around, sort of to turn the place in the kit where the snare usually lives into a place where something like the timbale is. And the timbale in Latin music is an ornamental instrument in a way, right? It's something that's constantly decorating and changing, and it is not necessary that it be there to keep the beat. It's also doing all sorts of other things.
I've heard a different kind of ways played today. Sometimes, you know, there's a few tombali plays around, I mean, I don't know if they're still around, that never got the recognition, and one is from Cuba, named Cuco Sanchez. Everybody, when I was coming up, you know, the tombali player everybody was talking about was Tito Puente. And from a social perspective, I thought Tito was happening too until I found out something different. That Tito was trying to be more like a rudimental player. If you watch his stuff, he's trying to be like a rudimental drummer. And so some of the people within the inner circle knew that. And I didn't realize that, and I should have had my buddy down here today. Mm-hmm. And real, I had him at the Bennington tribute, Renato Chacon, who I met in sixth grade. His family was from Cuba. And I didn't know who his father was. We used to go up to his house. I thought it was just another guy. He didn't really speak English, you know. But his son used to tell me about him. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, your father, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then his father, remember one time, had us in the house, and he grabbed some bongos out. And he put on his 45 recording. He started playing bongos. And, you know, I was telling his father played bongos. But Ray was telling me, my father played with this band, played with that band, and so on. I paid no attention. And in 1961, I was up at the Palladium Ballroom. And I was up there with Bill Fitch. If you don't know who Bill Fitch was, he's passed away. But he's in called Hall of Fame now. Former player. We was out in New Haven Projects in Connecticut. And his big time showcasing was with Cal Jada, 1961-62. But he didn't, he had a lot of problems. He didn't have problems, but the Hispanic community had problems with him. Because he was African American. And Willie Bobo, who was Puerto Rican, recommended him for the job. So Willie said that all the Spanish guys were getting on him because he recommended the non-Spanish guy for the gig. So they asked Willie, well, why did you recommend him? So he said, Willie told me, he said, man, he played better than the Spanish guys. So he could play everybody. And so this was my partner, 19 years old. So we had this close, knitted thing together. So we went up to the old Palladium Ballroom this night. It was a big night up there. So all of a sudden, I seen my friend's father there. I had never seen him out of South Jamaica. He had his suit on. He was all cool. He was on the floor dancing. I said, Bill, man, that's my buddy's father. It blew me away. And Bill said, he's doing all the old Cuban steps. He was doing that slick stuff. And I was watching him. I didn't want to see the bands, nobody. I'm just watching my friend's father. And then he stopped dancing, and he walked towards the stage. And Tito Puente was playing. And Tito Puente stopped playing and looked at him and bowed his head and took a side step and gave him the sticks. And the old, they used to call him the old man. He came on the stage and he took over the tambales, and I said, wow. And he didn't play like none of those guys. He didn't play, you know, either on the shells or the cowbell or his left hand doing this. He's saying, he wasn't doing that so-called paleolithic. He wasn't doing none of that. He was I said, my gracious. So you can do all that stuff, huh? They thought that was for the small so-called quinto. You know, you doing all these. I said, you can do it. And that's what I thought you should be doing.
Is that what you're doing right there?
Huh? Oh, look at that. This guy, me. I'm talking to him. You know, that's good, John. He was right on it. Okay, so that's Bill Fitch. That's Lowell Carter. And that's Pete Yellen. You know who that piano player is?
Chick Corea.
We were 18 and 19 years old. We was a new sensation in New York. We was blowing anybody. Who them young kids can play like that? And Pete Yellen passed away about a year ago. And Pete Yellen, I took a demo we had over to a Charlie Parker fan. And this older guy, he said, I didn't know Charlie Parker played Latin like that. I said, man, that's Pete Yellen. He said, who's Pete Yellen? I thought that was Charlie Parker. Then we took the demo up to Parker Foundation. It was a Doris Parker, one of his lady friends. She got blown away. She said, my gracious, this is Charlie. So Bill introduced me to Chick Corea. He had just come down from Chelsea, Mass. Then I had another band. And then Chick said, man, I got an alto player, man. I said, well, I got the bass player. And the thing about Noel, he's the one that got me really involved in to doing more of the scientific research on what music is. Because at this time, I was playing by this. I ain't know about no notes and none of that stuff. We played by memory, which I'm glad I came up that way. You have to listen. You play that thing down, I got it, I hear it. I said, let me hear it. Okay, I knew everything in there. And it's funny, man, because we were out in this club in the community. We're doing. I was getting all the gigs in these dance halls. So we're out here in St. Albans, at the St. Albans Terrace. So we're playing, so everybody from the housing project was there. All my old buddies, you know? And we was playing opposite Charlie Palmieri's band, okay? Eddie Palmieri's brother. And so I'm on the stage, and these guys got all these charts out. And they gave me a chart. And my nickname was Modi. That's what they used to call me, the housing projects. So I'm on the stand, and I got this music on these stands. And when I left the stand, they said, Modi, you reading that music? I said, yeah, it ain't nothing to it. I wouldn't mean nothing. I was pretending like I didn't know what the hell was going on, but I had everything memorized. You know, so it was him. You had to learn how to read music. Then later on, I said, man, I said, that's all right. I can do this here. I'm going to keep it in here. And so anyway, yeah, that's a lot of his. But anyway, with Noel, we had a rehearsal one time. And so we left the rehearsal. That's when I had a band with Ray McKinley, who's no longer with us. He was a piano player. And his sister was a viol player with the band. You don't have that photo.
No.
Jake, you got that one. Okay, his sister on vibes. And she was one of the original so-called jazz players around, or institute or conservatory trained people that got their PhD, okay, in the jazz before Donald Byrd, Billy Taylor, any of them. And so she was the smart one. So we had a rehearsal, and then when the rehearsal was over, Noel left. And I remember him saying, he's got a great sound, but he's playing all out of tune. I said, what do you mean I'm playing out of tune? It sounds good to me. I couldn't understand that for nothing. So I said, I got to find out, what do they mean playing out of tune and all this and all that? So I went up to the library. And I went up to the library, and I got my mother's shopping cart. And I'd come back to the library through the housing projects, and I was looking weird, man. Because there was no restriction on how many books you could take out the library. That cart would be, you know, Hindemith's books, Walk the Piston. I had everybody's books on theory, harmony. I said, I'm going to find this out. What's going on with this wrong note? I said, you mean to tell me this is what this is about? Somebody throughout history who got empowered to be a spokesman for the music said, you should do it like this and shoot. I said, bump that stuff.
Yeah.
I said, if it sounds good to me, it's all right. And if it's good for the people, and we going to play in them dance halls, and them people just be moving and all that. I said, that's what counts. Not somebody being very studious, and you think it's happening, and ain't nobody responding.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing if you listen to South African jazz or African
right.
jazz generally.
Right.
The saxophone players are always, quote unquote, out of tune.
Oh, man.
But it's a thing. It's a sound. It's a very particular sound. And it's beautiful. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And and people always said that about Jackie McLean. And they said that about Roscoe Mitchell, too.
Oh, man.
And it's
take
like,
that stuff.
Well,
that's take a, that stuff. If it sounds good to you, go for it.
Yeah.
That's what all the people be talking about. If it sounds good, go for it.
Yeah.
That's what really counts. It's not being up there being hit and you thinking you're hearing something. But you've been trained to say that, oh, that person, that's the ideal person, that's the number one person. And you gotta be, yeah, that's it, man, isn't it? Blah, 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 blah. I remember a time, and I won't go through names, but somebody came back on the scene after a long departure, and they're playing. I said, this is a shame. This was a few years ago. I said, this is a shame that they have this person on this stage playing, and the person is not in no condition right now. The person didn't even recognize me. And they knew me. I said, something's wrong here. You know, I said, they shouldn't be trying to push this person out here. Then I see this guy about a week later. He said, yeah, man, so-and-so is back on the scene, man. And he's playing, man. And he's playing. He's boom, boom, boom. He's playing, man. I said, look at Joe's mouth. And Joe's figuring out, who is he talking about? It ain't you, Joe. Don't worry about that. You ain't never disappeared. We got Joe back here as one of the greatest horn players on the scene. Yeah. Everybody don't get the publicity like everybody else. You know what I mean? And that's what you got to be careful for. There's a lot of people out here that's good that just don't get that kind of, those kind of problems. But Joe is one of the guys, you know? And I know that because we did a duo together, right? It's called with you, so I know what time of day it is with Joe. So, anyway, what the hell was I talking about just now?
I don't name names.
And because I'm getting older, something took me back to some stories here. Oh, names, yeah. So the guy saw me, he said, man, that guy is playing, man. I said, yo, my man, I said, you talking to me? I said, stop it right now. You trying to be hit, man. And he quieted down. I said, the guy was not playing, man. He's not in shape, man. All you're doing is remember him from the 60s, maybe, and the 70s. But the person's been on the scene for a little while. He's just not in sync right now. He's got to get back into sync. So all this thing about this person is supposed to be like this and it's supposed to be like that. You know, at least Michael Jordan was smart enough when he tried to come out of retirement and get back in that club, Kobe and those guys. You know, you ain't the old guy no more. So somebody gonna come in and he's on the court and say, man, this guy was fantastic. He outplayed this guy. I said, come on, stop it. Maybe before, but not now. So let's be real about the situation.
Yeah. That goes back to what you were saying, just about listening and paying attention to really what you hear.
Right.
Which is hard. Then you're not talking about reputation and you're not talking about what you used to know.
Right.
You're about listening to what you actually hear.
Right.
Which is hard. I mean, yeah. We have all sorts of baggage in our heads, so being able to hear it. So
you know, going back to these days like this, and we're talking about like Latin, there's a person who departed from the planet who used to get interviews. And, you know, I never had a chance to talk with him about this. And tell him, you know, you need to get your life in order. And, you know, when you don't know about something, you should be quiet. But they always found it necessary for some reason to say that, Milford Graves, man, he don't know nothing about bebop. He come from that Latin stuff. And I wanted to tell him, do you know what do you mean Latin stuff? See, you don't have to understand what Latin music is about. Not the stuff they throw you in the studio and tell you to do it this way, and to tell you to do it that way. I'm talking about the real deal stuff. The real deal stuff. The stuff that came out of maybe West Africa, you see? So if you go ahead and so-called Congo beat, the so-called tombao, okay? So you got to look back and say, okay, you got to think of the Congo. You got to think of the so-called Rumba. You know, things like that, the stuff before it came into, you know, out of there and started to get more commercialized and it started to get more westernized. Fernando Ortiz, I think, who wrote that book on, tried to write that book on Bata. And everybody said, man, he got it all screwed up, man. Everything he put in 4-4 and 2-4 should be triplets. Then you got to come back and say, what the heck is triplets? So you look at that stuff and they're playing it, it's a screw up. A lot of that stuff. It's just a script the way they were trying to interpret through arithmetic. It didn't work that because they left the language out. You breathe that thing out. So what you gonna put? You gonna put triplets? Then after every a little head on that stem, you're going to put dot, 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 dot. It don't work like that. You know how that thing expands and flows like that. So it's really about the language. It's not about trying to count it out. And that's where the screw up comes. Everybody talking about playing in time. And you make a statement. That's the time. You got to make a statement. Somebody asks you something, you make a statement. So the language aspect got lost, at least on the drums as it came into the jazz. And anyone who tells me, and I've heard people say, well, you know, jazz drumming, you know, that didn't come from like Africa. I said, you nuts. Where'd you get that from? I said, obviously you're not a drummer. You're not a musician who knows how things just transform, and sometimes even transmute it into another form. But the basic idea was what that didn't disappear. Yeah. It's how you articulate it. And you know, talking about the snare, I was socialized when I came in. The New York Hard Quartet, I heard a guy tell me one time and said, he said, yeah, man. He said, you'd be the man if you played snare. And then people said, he don't know how to play a snare. I said, well, you fool, you don't know my history. Listen to my early recordings. You hear I was using a snare on there. But I did that to participate.
This snare right here.
Yeah. Then after I got out, after I participated, and everybody knew what time of day it is, I said, goodbye, snare. Yeah. I said, you go. I'm going to play no ornamental drumming.
Yeah.
You know? And today, you know, all the drummers, I'm trying to tell all the drummers, get rid of them snares. I know Logan and all the companies don't like me. They'll probably never give me no endorsement. Nothing. They said, that guy, he's out to ruin us. You know? Well, I can't help it. I'm sorry. You know, I just see, you know, it's the language on there, you know.
It's interesting hearing you talk about language, too, because having worked with you on a few concerts in different places, a vocal mic is always a presence
right. For
you. And right. Having it there at your side, it's not in front because that gets in the way, but it's something that you can either turn back to or pull into the front. Because vocalizing is a big part of it for you. And so there's a right. Language component, and I always feel like you're having also a dialogue with the drums, with your voice. Your voice becomes another of the possible voices in that. I mean, we saw that really well demonstrated there in the snippet that we looked at.
Right.
I want to ask you a little bit about the transition into playing, let's say, in the New York Art Quartet and in some of those contexts. And maybe if you could talk a little bit about that scene when you came into it and what your early experiences of it, because you were an important part of that scene for its entire existence while it was, as it transformed from what it was in the early days
right. Into
the loft scene. And,
right. And
so you have a unique perspective on that, and I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about that transition to playing with groups that were jazz groups, playing in those contexts.
Well, I think it started when I was doing this Latin gig up in Mount Vernon in a nightclub. So we had Bill Fitch, and we had some local guys, Bill and myself. And Bill told me, he said, you know, a friend of mine is coming from down from Rhode Island, coming up from Rhode Island. And he said, he's a cool friend of mine, man, you know, and he's going to come down and check us out and sit in with us. It was my good departed friend, Don Elias. So Don came down, we played, and then that summer came around, because this was in the winter, and Don called me up and said, hey, man, I'm going to be doing this gig up in Boston, man, the Rare Beach Club called the Club Ebtide, and I want you to come on up, man, and play. So I said, fine. So I got my bags and went on up there for the whole summer. Then I brought my family up there, and I was able to get a little loft off of Mass and what, I forgot the other big avenue there from Boston, right around for the Symphony Hall there. And so I was up there, and then people was telling me, man, you need to go check out this these jam sessions they have on Sunday. I don't know, it could have been Conley's up there or something. So I went over there to check it out, and Sonny Stitt was like the house band. And so all his musicians was on the stage playing and blah, blah, I'm sitting there. Then all of a sudden, this alto player walks on the stage. Everybody said, there's that weird dude, man. And they all walked off the stage. And he started playing. And I said, that dude sounds cool to me. So I went up on the stage, you know, and I started getting on the set. And I did what I thought was supposed to be done. And after that day, we finished, he came up, hey, you know, man, he said, I got a little place, I'll take you around there, man, maybe we'll talk some more. It was just Sheffy Logan. That's how I met Sheffy Logan. So anyway, he would come up to my house and we start playing and so on and so on and so on. And just before that, I had known the bass player John Nesbitt because I met him when Bill was with Cal Jada. So I went to see him, and he was living over top of the piano player Hal Galper. So Hal Galper, man, had this drum set and this little loft. And so Hal wanted to sell them at that time. Get some cash flowing, man. So I brought the drum set from him. And which he wanted back, but no way. So everybody, I wanted to tell Tony Williams and all those guys in the Boston. I said, man, I'm playing on that set that all you dudes used to play on. Up there in Boston, man, the jam session band. So I had him in my loft and I was just jamming, man, you know? So one time we went over to the club at Ebtide, and so it was kind of empty in there. We were supposed to be playing Latin. So we had this alto player, Dick Mesa, who was Mexican. And Dick, he passed away too. And we had a Russian piano player, Don Elias, and myself. And Don was doubling between bass and fungo. And I'm playing timbali. So Dick said, look, man, it's empty, man. Let's play some jazz. I said, I don't want to play no jazz, man. Let's play some Latin. And so he said, well, you know, man, and everybody used to say, get a cymbal when you play timbali. I said, I don't want no doggone cymbal, man. I said, I got the shell of the drum. I got a cowbell and I got my skins. That's all I need. And them two drums in front of me. And so Dick talked me into it. He said, man, you know, play a little bit like chang, chang, chang. I said, okay. Chang, 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 chang. And I was unconsciously working my left. And when he stopped, Dick looked at everybody and said, man, do you see what this guy's doing with his left hand? I said, well, what am I doing with my left hand? I'm just playing with it. He said, man, you should be playing jazz. So I said, you think so, Dick? He said, yeah, so I went back to the set I brought from Howard Galpa. Because look, the set to me, I didn't know about no trap drum set. I know he had a bunch of drums, and I said, I got a bunch of chance to get more drums right now. And I was just playing, man. Wasn't no restriction. I was playing the way I was playing traditional stuff. So Zeffney was liking it, and I wouldn't have no problem. And he'd have Fred Ballard. Do you remember Fred Ballard? Anybody remember Fred Ballard?
No.
Trumpet player? Elvin used him briefly. But he had some other things and he had to get up the scene. But he was going to be the new trumpet player on the scene, like 65, 60. Everybody was talking about Fred Ballard. Everybody was talking about Fred Ballard. He just disappeared. So anyway, Fred would come by, man. We was all up there jamming. Hakeem was a Jermaine, the bass player. He would come up there. They were all the Boston guys. And so I'm just playing. Nobody was being disturbed. And then it was time to leave. And I told the chef, I said, man, why don't you move to New York? He was a little hesitant. Then I talked him into moving to New York. He was down here, and then the chef called me and said, look, man, I'm going to this rehearsal, man. And he said, I met these two guys, and they invited me to this rehearsal. So he said, you want to go? I said, yeah, man. He said, they're jazz guys. I said, fine, I'll go over, man. And it was in this guy Michael Snow's loft. And the two guys was Roswell Rudd and John Cheekai. So what's the drummer again? J.C. Moses. So they had J.C. Moses in the band and the other a bass player. He's on one of the people's. I forgot his name, man. A taller guy, man.
Right. The guy who said you were a wizard and he was terrified of you.
Yeah, that could have been the guy. Yeah. Sounds good at least to me. I don't know if that's real. But I think I frightened him a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
Some of the guys couldn't believe it. It's unbelievable, man. But then you bring back some old stuff, man. So anyway, they played, man. I'm on the side. I'm checking it out. So then Giuseppe said, you think my friend can sit in, man? So they said, sure. So JC got up. And I got on the drums and I played. JC was just looking at me. JC ain't said nothing. And JC left. Don Moore was the bass player.
Don Moore, exactly.
And JC Moses left. And then they had recorded it from reel to reel. And they're listening. And I said, wow, that's what I sound like? I said, don't sound too bad, huh? I'm talking about myself, because I didn't know what the hell I was. The sound didn't sound like. I was just so free. I wasn't even thinking about it. I was just doing it. I said, that sound. And John Ross said, wow, that's the kind of drummer we always wanted. They said, you want to be in the band? I said, yeah. And J.C. Moses did not like me after that.
My God.
No, he lost his job. And then all of a all of a sudden, before I know it, we did a few gigs. Actually, I remember meeting Herbie Hancock at Midtown. Mm-hmm. And Herbie went up. I said, man, hi, Herbie, how you doing? You know, checking Herbie. I'm a young guy, you know. And he looked at me, he said, and I said, I'm Milford Graves. He said, oh, you're Milford Graves, huh? He said, everybody's talking about you. I said, everybody talk about me? This is a beautiful way to come on the scene. Don't be thinking you're somebody. Let other people, listen to what other people are saying. So stuff starts floating around. All of a sudden, I see all these musicians, drummers out there, you know? And I always wanted to tell some of these guys, I never told, I always asked Marcus Gilmore. I said, your grandfather remember me? Marcus always says, yes, he does. And I said, I got to make it my business to see Roy Haynes before it's too late. They said, Roy, it was you, Max, Elvin, Philly Joe. I ain't never met Art Blakely. Mm. But he used to go around telling everybody they need to check my drum solos out. Mm. But those guys, I always wanted to tell those guys, I said, no, it was you two guys, or you four guys, man, when I was a young guy, that made me continue to do what I was doing. Because the compliments they would give me was like with Roy, the guy was at the bar at Slugs, when I was playing with Albert Iowa. They said, Roy came in, you know, because he's a shorter guy, and it was crowded. And they said, Roy walked in while we were playing, and they said, Roy hollered out, who's on drums? And he jumped on the stool, man, and stayed up there. I said, Roy Haynes did that? I said, I must be doing something, huh? And it's not bebop in the usual sense. And then it was over, Roy came up there, man. He smiled, man. He not seen nothing much. And every time I see Roy in the street, he's always greeting, man. And Elvin did the same thing. When I was with Giuseppe, he thought Farrell was supposed to be playing, but Farrell canceled out. And I'm down at this gallery on St. Mark's Place, man. And playing, man, you know, we started, a little bit of people there. And then all of a sudden I looked at the little small gallery. And in the entrance, I seen Coltrane. I said, John's here. I got my seat and said, John's here, man. I started bringing it up. I said, I got to do it because Coltrane's here. Because he thought Farrell was there. He really came to see Farrell. Then all of a sudden, John walked in. I'm grooving, man. You know, I'm just doing my number, just gone, man. That's the time I seen Coltrane. I said, you got to be on top of it. Then all of a sudden, Elvin walks in. I said, Elvin, man. I said, Elvin's here. You know, Elvin, like, that laid out. How Elvin was doing it, man. And I started stretching out, man. Like Elvin, you know what I mean? But doing my thing. Elvin looked at the door, and Elvin was flying, man, through the house. He came and said about right here in the first down, I was right here. Elvin just grabbed the seat like this, and Elvin had me gone, man. I always want to say, Elvin, man, you had me gone, man. I could not fail. And Max was always cool. Max was always cool. Max would see me and say, man, you got something else different. We gotta get together, man. You know? And Philly Joe, he had another way. He come down there in the last set. Ha! We playing five nights, three sets. And I'm wiped out the fifth night on the third set. About 3 o'clock in the morning. And Philly comes in and just looking like the old dudes, man. The big Applejack on, you know, old Philly Joe, man, that street stuff. And he looked at Albert and said, who does MF on drums? And I had this finished. I said, what you say? You know, my old street corner stuff came back. My old jitterbugs. I said, Mama, what you say? He looked and said, man, wow. That was what Philly said. I like it. I didn't catch it at first. So these are the kind of guys that say, you know what? I'm gonna keep doing it.
And that was the legendary set of concerts at Slugs that you're talking about.
Yeah.
When at the very end,
yeah,
he came in. Because that was, how many nights was it? Five?
That was five nights, three sets. Wow. The second night, I think it was either the first night, could have been the first night, and the second set, Don Pullen came down and Don told me, he said, man, you ain't gonna be able to play like that for five nights, three sets. I said, you wait to see Don. The first night after the second set, Albert Isla came over to me and said, man, we got to play more ballads. I said, you got to play more ballads. And up his reading a little bit and start to swallow. You got to remember, so called free jazz high energy, we was just getting little log gigs. You play 45 minutes an hour, you would never test it over the long run. Playing at that high energy, that's what we're. Albert tells that story. And Albert, bless you, but you got it screwed up. I did not pass out. Albert tells the story about I passed out. I didn't pass out. Slugs had nothing but a bathroom, and you was competing with the customers. You know, wasn't no restroom. Lucky I had a friend that lived right around the corner. And after every set, I would go to his house, and I'd get on that couch, and I would sleep in the break. And I'd come back. But I said to myself, I will never try that again. Too much. It was too much. The kind of explosive energy like that. And that's what we learned during that time. Saying, this is not club music to be playing like this here. Concert music, you know, we take care of ourselves. So we're going to play that high energy. You know, it's not living that so-called regular, you know, getting high, not taking care of yourself. I said, no, that's out. That's when I said, you know what, I'm going to preserve myself. I'm going to keep myself in shape. Because I realized one thing. When, in 1965, when I remember Don Ellis, right? He's talking about playing like quarter tones. And he's talking about only if we can blow a quarter tone piano. And everybody was talking stuff. And they're talking about Indian music and all that. So I said, I'm gonna study. I ain't gonna just listen to records. So I found a guy who was head of school of Indian, the school of Indian music. And he had a little brownstone up in the 90s. And he was advertising the Yellow Pages. So I went up to this guy, who was an older guy at that time. You know, I'm 23, he was like 64. And I talked to the guy, I liked the guy. He wasn't actually, he knew the basics of tabla, but he was really a string player. And so I guess he liked me because he was like a kind of lonely guy. But everybody knew about him. They'll talk about Washanta Singh, Dr. Washanta Singh. And I know he said Coltrane had called him. Actually, Washanta Singh was the one who taught Yosef Lateef. Mm-hmm. No, not Yosef Lateef. What's the other guy that went to Board of Education? Abdul Malik. Taught all those ouds and all those instruments. It was Dr. Washanta Singh. Mm-hmm. And I remember him telling me, he said, many times I'm going to tell him to leave because he must know how to sing what he is playing. Not memorization, not memorizing things and all that stuff there. So anyway, I took tabla lessons with him. I was studying with the guy. And I was getting at it quick because I already knew how to play bongo and touch. I just had to make some, it wasn't wrong with the digits. I had to learn the technique, man, of, you know, getting those tones out of there. And so anyway, he would get up, he would grab every string instrument he had, and he would say, play, play, play. And he was just grooving. And it was more than a lesson. So anyway, I gotta find out where I'm going with this. It's deep when, you know, all these stories come. I be saying this and all of a sudden I go back in the old memories. Y'all gotta forget there's an audience here. But I start thinking about some other stuff right now. I gotta be cool because I can't tell y'all too much. You gotta keep that in the closet. I said, cool, man.
You were talking about the fact that you knew you had to learn. So rather than only listening.
Oh, yeah. Off the scene, you know, and I said, wow, this is, no, one, I know what, Washanta Singh told me, because I asked him, I said, what do you think about Ravi Shankar? He says, so Ravi Shankar was 45. He said, he's still, you know, when he gets over 50, he get good. Because Dr. Singh was like 64. And I'm saying, over what? I'm 20 years old. And I'm pumped up. At this time, I'm being all publicized. I mean, I got to get 50 before I know what time of day it is. I think everything is cool, man. And it was great. When I got 50, I used to tell all the young people, I said, when you get over 50, you'll be all right. You know, so I'll run that down to you now. I said, you know, I said, okay, I'll tell you over 70 now because I'm over 70. I said, when you get over 70, you'll really get put together. But I don't want to turn you off, but I'm telling you, you know, it's a great feeling. that I don't feel like this is going disappearing. I just growing here. All the stuff, and I said, wow. But you got to keep yourself in some kind of spiritual, mental order. I'm trying to keep my body in a certain kind of way, you know. But my body is facing some wear and tear. I think I'm a great teacher of martial arts now, because I know how to tell you not what to do. Not what to do. Don't stay in too long. You know what I mean? I was trying to hang out with too many young people. You know what I mean? And I said, well, my body is getting wear and tear. You can't be over 50 or 60 years old doing all this stuff, like MMA and all that crazy stuff. You know, they just beat you up. But other than that, here, I can see the growth factor, how you put this with that and everything. So all that is starting to gel in right now. But I don't think I would have been able to do it if I would have been out here doing this gig, that gig, all over the place. And one of the greatest things that happened to me in my life was to get myself organized and settled down, was to accept a job in 1973 at Bennington College. You know, and it was Bill Dixon, the one that really, at that time, he said a position open, and he asked me to come on up there with him. And I didn't want to do it. I said, I ain't going to no campus and teach. And Bill was already up there. He said, but grades, you're going to get a paycheck. I said, a paycheck? A paycheck, man. So that means I got some regular money coming in. Yeah. I said, yeah, let me try it. I went up there, signed a one-year contract. I wound up staying up there 39 years, man.
Wow.
But, however, if it wasn't going to Bennington, I don't know if I would have met Jake. That's how we met. And a lot of other people I know that came through there. So that was a good move to be able to stabilize me. And the deal I got up there was great, because I get enough pay to take care of things off my check. I never wanted full-time, I just wanted part-time. I was my own boss, I set my hours, and no one ever told me what to teach, how to teach it, so I was still doing all my creative, innovative work up there for all of that time. I said, you can't go wrong.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about that Eiler string of concerts at Slugs as a sort of turning point,
right,
in a way, in your realization that was when that instead of doing long nights at clubs, that then
right,
looking for a way to support yourself and be able to pick and choose concert hall concerts, because that ended up really influencing how you presented your music to the world. I mean, from then on,
right,
in a lot of ways. And in a lot of ways, it took you out of the so-called jazz life.
Right.
Which is probably why you're, you know, continuing to grow your music and expand all the different things that you're doing, which is an integrative thing. And I want to ask you some things about that. I'm going to run through a couple of slides here just to get to another
right,
place that links to what right, we're talking about. I'll just mention what they are as we go by on them. This is at John Coltrane's funeral, and that's Milford up in the corner, and that's Albert Eiler. And they played at that funeral, and Joe McPhee was there at that concert. When concert is the wrong, but at that memorial. Here's a record that Milford and Don Pullen made, called Nomo. I'm just going to run through a bunch of these records. This is live at Yale. And these were all made on your own record label.
Yeah, SRP. That was in the 60s in this self-reliance program, called the self-reliance program. And it was like when ESP was recorded us with Bernard Stoneman, and everybody was talking about when Bernard Stoneman was ripping everybody off. I always called it the good rip-off. I always thought of Bernard Stoneman as a public relations agent,
mm-hmm,
because he was the one that pushed a lot of the music out. So I said, it ain't nothing about it. You didn't get paid right and all that. I said, I wasn't even concerned about that. As a matter of fact, I was at a restaurant one time, and Bernard was in there with another guy, and I sat down at a sales table, and I sat down with him. And Bernard looked at me, looked at the guy, and said, you know, he said, Milford's smart, man. So I'm saying, what is Bernard talking about, I'm smart? He said, I recorded him, I publicized him, I put his record all out, and he comes and forms his own company. I said, exactly right. I said, you're exactly right. You publicized me, man. So now, well, I'm going to put my own stuff out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so that's what, that was a kind of thing, like saying, don't be keep waiting around. You know, Don and myself, when we did that record, actually, that's when Giuseppe started to just go his own way. And so I told Don, we had the quartet, I told Don, I said, look, why don't we just connect together? We do some duos. And so there was a student group up there called me up at the Yale. They wanted me to go and do a solo. So I said, Don, look, I got this gig doing a solo. I said, but I'm not interested in doing a solo. I said, why don't we do a duo? And I said, the money they're paying me, we'll just split it down, man. And we do that. And then after that, I told Don, I said, no, let's not split the money down, Don. Let's take our money, man, and let's record ourselves. So Don said, fine. So I called an old high school friend, and he came up to Yale, and he recorded this. Mm-hmm. And that's how that started. It wasn't to start a recording company. It was about, you know, not waiting for somebody to record us and put us out there.
Self-documentation.
That's right.
And then the earliest versions of the records had hand designed covers.
Right.
These are, you painted these mostly, or you and Don.
Those ones I think I did with Don. We used to get down and get that acrylic paint. And because I remember Jan Tilden, the same guy that used to work at Slugs, he was at Sam Goody's. And he was an artist. He was a good artist.
Yeah.
Okay? So Jan said, look, I can get you a deal on the covers, man, because I'm at Sam Goody's. We'll work a deal out. So he said, but they're blank covers. I said, Jan, I don't have no money, man, to buy no labels. He said, because he's a painter, he said, paint the covers yourself. I said, what a great idea. So when I got those acrylics, and me and Don would sit down and say, I'm going to do this stroke. Don, you do that stroke. We sit down and put those things out. And that's how that came about.
Yeah. Amazing. Absolutely. Well, so this is outside of one of the lofts in the 70s.
Is that the studio we went?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So that Milford's here, Frank Lowe, a variety of people from the scene. I don't know anything about this picture.
That photo was in Festac. Okay, that was taken when we was in Festac. Now, Nadi Kumar is right here.
That's Nadi Kumar?
That's not Sterling Gibbons. I don't know if you know Sterling Gibbons or Nadi Kumar.
Through Mingus.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, through Mingus.
Yeah.
Now he taught, what's the guy, man, that was a composer that talked about the Lydian scale?
Yeah, George Russell.
George Russell. And a lot of people don't know about him. You know, he's still alive.
He's still alive. He's like 100.
He's 101 or something like that, 102.
Yeah, he lives in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Every once in a while, I talk to his wife, because sometimes they hear it all that together.
He makes instruments. He's an instrument builder.
Yeah. Actually, I got a great, that's something we can talk about. Great cassette recording of us up in Bennington to do with us, too.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, that was in Festac. That was in Nigeria when they had the Nigerian festival in 1977. That's when that was taken. And those other three guys are Nigerians. We were right on the site where all the artists were living.
Wow. Here's a 70s photograph. I just thought it was a nice photograph. Also, we're going to see a picture of Milford's drum kit in a few minutes. And this is an earlier incarnation of the hand-painted drum kit. And one other thing here which is important to know is that Milford doesn't use a second head on the drums. And that's a acoustical, philosophical idea. Do you want to say anything about the fact of not using a second head?
Well, there's a reason why I do not use a bottom head. Because if I use a bottom head, then I don't have to hear anything that I'm saying. Enough has been said. You know what? In 1977, my first trip to Japan, this guy, Watazumi, Dozo Watazumi, he's no longer. He was the so-called great shakuhachi player at the time. So a lot of people was going over to Japan to study with Watazumi. So Toshi, Tutori, was my student for 2 years.
Yeah.
So he came over to 75 to stay with me. Then he asked me, so you want to go to Japan? I said, fine. So he knew this guy, Ida.
Opera,
yeah. Yeah,
sure.
So Ida was a highly respected writer and all that over there. So Ida and them came to my house. Actually, they came here. It was about three other Japanese. And they went around the studio ribbon. They went all over the place. They wanted to bring some into free jazz improvisational musicians to Japan. And they wanted them to tour. So they went around to see everybody. And they said, you know what? You are the best for the Japanese group. Because they didn't want to bring people over there who were like hanging out all the time. You know, they saw, you know, the whole way I had everything structured. They said, you'll be more responsible. Comes to the Japanese, the family and everything like this here. So I went over there and it was great because they weren't jazz musicians. These were like intellectuals, you know, really into the culture. So I had a chance to go to all the countryside, all these places that normally you don't go if you was brought over by a jazz promoter.
So you saw a bunch of temples.
Oh, yeah.
Which brings us to maybe also talk a little bit about this, because what I wanted to spend some time today talking a little bit about your house and the significance of your house also in relation to what we were talking about in terms of not necessarily having to gig all the time. So can you just say a few words about how you came to live here?
Okay, well, first of all, it was Deepesh who was coming over here with the Uber driver. He was Ecuadorian, and he said, about my house, is an old house. He thought I had moved in there. And as soon as I had worked itself out, and he found out that I did all his work, his whole tone changed. Mm-hmm. He didn't put it all together. His whole conversation, I could see him lift up a little bit. What did he say? I like you. He said, I like you. You know, he thought he'd come to the South Jamaica, pick up some guy and move into a house. And it was, he said, it's so different from everybody else's so on. Well, what happened was, I had to get some work done on one of the windows. And this, I wasn't going out to do nothing different all of a sudden. All of a sudden, I got up there and I said, man, I ain't going to have no new windows put in the same old drive windows. And I started putting a little this and that, you know. And people started coming by and said, oh, I like that. So one window led to another window and led to another window. And then some people said, are you going to do the whole house like that, the front? And I'm hesitating. Yeah, I'm going to do it. I had no plans to do it. But too many people in the neighborhood was coming by and said, oh, I like that. You know?
I just had to stop you to say, I came over once when you were working on the house.
Oh, okay.
And you showed me, well, first of all, you did it more or less alone.
Right.
And you showed me, I come over to the house and there's a ladder against the house.
Right.
And there's a board with mosaic on it.
Right.
By the side of the house that I couldn't move. Like I couldn't, personally, could not pick it up. It was so heavy. So I said, how are you going to get this up there? You have somebody coming with a crane, or what's the deal? No, I just move it up there myself. I said, how? He said, I pick it up. I said, how do you get it on that? He said, I pick it up, and I schlep it up the, and you put it on the side of it. You find a way to put it on the side of the house. I couldn't believe it. And all of these were assembled that way, right?
Yeah.
It was mind blowing, actually.
So now you know why my back is suffering. It keeps up after a while, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, this one skips ahead, so we'll come back to it. But these are all exterior shots. Now the house itself was your grandmother's house.
My grandmother's house.
And you inherited it.
Right.
Which in a way puts you in a really interesting position in terms of being able to then not have that worry in terms of constant mortgage payment or whatever. That's one thing. So you've got Bennington on the one hand, you've got a home, and what that allowed you to do as well was create a laboratory
or a workplace that was kind of an amazing, continues to be this incredible secret laboratory, studio, dojo, which we'll look at in some detail. And then this is when you go in the stairs on the way down into your studio, and it's all painted. So when roughly did you paint?
Okay, I started this out, and Miss Shy is right here right now. Look at her. Here she goes. My wife's sitting right here. Talk, don't say nothing. She got a brush in there. One day I came in, I said, "This is pretty slick. What happened?" She started to get her little two cents in there. That's pretty cool. You know? You know what's pretty cool? It's because we've known each other since the sixth grade. So we kind of like know each other in a lot of different ways. Even if it ain't that outside, you know, it's a lot of stuff that's going on. So, you know, if I move this way, she may move that way. So if I got a stroke this way, she said, okay, we curve it this way. You know what I mean? This way and so on, so on, so on. So we jumped that in there together as a team. So that's how that you know. You know, I'm always saying, like, you know, if you can get contractors that build homes, well, what kind of wallpaper should we have? I'm saying, well, you should hire artists. Let the artists paint on the walls. That's the wallpaper.
Yeah.
That's a new way of doing it. And the artists come in for therapeutic reasons, and you can have these little thin pieces of slide, like instead of pull-down shades, you got all these art pieces that can pull down here, just slide this way. And they come and say, wow! And if you buy a phone and put it in the house, they say, I thought you lived down the block. This is not your house. Oh, yes, it is. Wait a minute. Boop, boop, push the button. Wow, so that's that wall that I saw 2 weeks ago. You know, and this is my whole thing, what I'm saying. I try to, you know, do it without having a showcase room or whatever else. But it's to show the possibilities. Plus, you know, hey, we got these eyes. And that's all important, just to look at things. You know, that's a teacher. No one has to constantly be talking to you all the time about something. But the more you can visualize the possibilities of coloring and design and things like that there, you know what I mean? And that's what I try to focus on. They constantly be stimulating the optic senses to be seeing all the possibilities. And just let it go sometimes. You know, don't worry about what people are going to say. And you know, we have to be able to self-turn ourselves on without being destructive. That's what I feel. We got to start doing some things like, how do we inspire ourselves? Because if we on top of it, inspire ourselves and cool like this here, somebody come down the street and say, man, that person that nuts, they're just happy. And that person's making me happy.
It's contagious.
Yeah, but my grandmother, you see, I had to visit her every Sunday when I was a kid. That was a rule. We lived about two blocks away, and my father said, you got to go around and see Grandma. And I would sit down with Grandma, and she was Grandma, because I'd be just like to see her. And Grandma would be talking to me. Always tried to and inspire me. And I used to call him my uncle, my grandfather, and it wasn't even about a blood situation here. Because they got my grandmother outlived three husbands. So she was the last one. And this guy was from the Barbados. So I got to know a whole lot of the Barbadian culture. I used to go into Brooklyn. And he was like, he dealt with wildlife and the whole bit and all that stuff. So he's always talking about just the way he would act and his whole character and his mannerisms and kindness. And if he'd go screaming, he'd say, come on, young man, let me, you know, taste this and taste that. So between the two of them, I was being cultivated in a certain kind of way. And my grandmother, she was always talking about, you can do whatever you want to do in life and blah, blah, blah. And kind of like kept me focused. And so when she passed in 1970, then I took over. And before that, I remember as a kid, they had, all I know was like when I was five or six, I used to see all these people there. And you could have people with all kind of looks, you know, because they came from the job. She used to work on 159. She's like a dressmaker. And she used to tell me, I was the first African-American that was ever hired in this company. And I remember going down here, and you know, all the workers was white folks. And then when she had these affairs, it'd be a lot of white folks mixed with African and Caribbeans and all like that. So I had got introduced to this kind of culture. And she said, you know, you as a little kid, everybody used to say, look at that little kid play that piano, the old roller piano I still got downstairs. I'd be entertaining everybody. I said, Grandma, I think I remember when a lot of people there, I was playing piano.
That's it. And right up there.
That's the old roller one, yeah. And they had a bar there. I still got the bar there, but I got all my herbs and stuff on there now. They had benches. You remember when we used to work at all the benches on there?
Right here.
And, yeah. Oh, and my grandfather, old guy came past one day and told me, he said, you know what? This used to be the top after hours place in Jamaica here. All I know, I seen them put big vats in there where they were maybe bootlegging. I don't know what the heck was going on. But old brick wine bottles and so on. So I think my grandma would be proud of me now.
Yeah,
I've turned it into a different kind of thing. You know, a different kind of element. So I kept that side, you know, really happening. But
yeah, like the social part of it too.
Yeah. But that was cool because she always wanted me to succeed. You know, and I said, boy, what a blessing. Because what you just said is true. I see people, they say, well, I want to do what you're doing all this. I said, you're not going to be able to do what I do if you have to work 8 hours. You got a job, you got this, you got that. I said, you have to have your time. You know what I mean? You really got to have your time. I think we all know that. We all want to have the time to do what we want to do, at least get some part of ourselves out there before we leave the planet. You know, some people, when they retire, they say, oh, I'm retired right now. What you going to do? I'm going to go fishing and I'm going to sleep. Not me. I may ride that fish. I ain't going to eat the fish. I'll take a ride through the ocean and see what I can see, take it to the deep sea, the bottom. But to go and just, you know, cool out, I don't know. So I always tell people, one of the keys to, like people say, well, how do you do this? How do you do that? I said, that's what I do. So I'm supposed to be halfway decent in what I do. So the main thing I do right now is what I feel real good about. I don't know if it's shortcuts. I try to deal with the functionalism of something. Don't take you on an intellectual trip. So I said, when I learned about all these different things I do, oh, I was going on all kind of trips. All kind of trips to learning. I said, yeah, that way you're going to have to spend 18 years to do it. I said, we want to learn the functional aspects of things. Now, not to jump too far ahead, when I was doing martial arts, and martial arts to me, what happened to martial arts was, I was working out, you know, like a guy came to me the other day, and he was talking to me, and he was talking about boxing, and he said something, and so he made mention about Mayweather. I said, you know what? I said, I'm 76. I said, give me one of them bouts. I said, I will take Mayweather. He said, what? You serious, man? I said, I will take Mayweather, man. I said, I'm 76, I will take him. He will look. Not to get too far off. McGregor would have did much better if he had some doggone endurance. McGregor would have did, because in the early part, if you see what was happening, man, Conor was doing all those angular movements. My man, was just coming up, he didn't know which way to go. No, he tied out, and he lost it. He didn't have a certain other kind of skill level to go in there to do it. See, bump size don't mean nothing to me. Don't mean nothing, you see. And it's because I'm not publicizing nothing, but you ask something and this has got to seep in. Now, I remember one time, this guy came to my house, and he was introduced to Hugh Glover. Mm-hmm. Hugh Glover's in South Carolina because I wanted him to come today. Okay. And so anyway, Hugh, I said, oh man, my co-worker, her fiance, he's a top-notch martial artist. He's an internal martial artist. And got a big-time rep. So he came on over, and this guy spoke fluent Chinese, lived in India for long, judo expert, had this type of thing, you know what I mean? He's sitting there looking at me now, you know. So anyway, and this guy's looking like this guy, big guy, you know, and so on and so on. And I see he wants to critique us. Who are these guys back here? Don't have no uniform look. We got sneakers on and all different colored sweatpants, you know, and everything. We just interviews with everybody. So it's time to get on the floor and do a little sparring. Now, he's supposed to be visiting. And I thought he was going to show these guys something, man, about what chi is and all this stuff and all this here. So this guy was a good, solid, defined, about 200 pounds, a little old, had the height. So I put one of my guys on him. He must have weighed about 130 something. So anyway, they got on the floor, and he just thought he was doing this and doing that. So he took my guy, threw him on a hip throw, and he was notorious. I found a letter. He tried to really hurt you, break you up. They couldn't find nobody in Chinatown to whip this guy. They'd go down here. Big rep. He threw the guy over. And the guy went over and just rolled right over. So he's standing there and he says, are you okay? So my guy looked at him. He's down on one knee or something. Said, are you okay? So he looks around at his lady friend to be his wife and said, and so she's saying, and he looked down here, and he found fingernails had ripped them right up in here. Mm. Okay, so he's one of my first guys, original guys, and I told him to come here today. You understand? Luke, could you just stand up? This is him, Robert Stevens, right here. you see, so this guy's all this rep, man. And you ain't supposed to do that. You ain't supposed to do that. So, I guess Floyd would say, well, who is this dude talking about? He can take me. $200 million, let's go.
Yeah.
$200 million, let's go. You're going to be surprised. You're going to be surprised. You're going to be really surprised. You know what I mean? The people, you know who you got to worry about? The things or the people you don't know. Not the ones who you know, because there's a lot of people on this planet that's smart and know how to do, and we don't know about it. So don't ever go out here and think you were the top and this and that. Don't do it. I'm telling you, don't do it. You don't know what will happen.
Let's run through some photographs of the dojo. This is Milford going into the dojo. And then that's not actually part of it. This is on the outside. I really wanted to have some of the images of the work that you've made. That's
now that's the revised one.
Yeah?
Yeah, because we got the old stuff, right, Jay? Right. You got the old stuff when it really looked like something you don't want to come into. That was old Coliseums and stuff like that. It looked dangerous when you opened that and came in there.
So this is the interior of the dojo. What time frame was the dojo?
I think around, is Wendell here?
Yes.
Wendell, stand up. I told all my old guys to come here, that way. Okay, now Wendell came here in 1988.
That's correct.
That's when the changes made, okay? So Wendell's one of my other guys, you know, my yard guy. Jason's back there, I seen him kneeling down. And Jason's one of my other guys, and the other original guy who's over here is Lester. Come on, Lester, don't wait, stand up. Now, these two guys has been around a long time with me. these were the original guys when we were hard knocking, and some people say we were the original UFC MMA. We were kind of crazy. People say, you're crazy to do that stuff. I mean, we were rough, we were tough, you know, and it was a harsh element. Those days are over, though. We don't do that anymore. But that's when we had, forget about it, that's when we was doing concrete floor back there. We had concrete, no mats. And people used to come down there, I don't care what kind of black belts they had, whatever they had, you know what I mean? People said, man, we were scared just with the same look. It was rough and it was really tough. And it was that was when it was a garage before it was converted. So I have that stuff we don't have here.
But it doesn't look like a garage now.
No, we have that. We have all that stuff there. That was the original, that was the original roar. A place that we had. Okay.
These are all images of the dojo or things that are in the dojo. So that's a, this is a work painting of yours.
Yes, it is.
I just thought it would be interesting for people to see the interior of the dojo also,
right,
because it's a place where you're doing a lot of different things.
Right.
So, I mean, I think one of the things that this brings me to, maybe this will be the last thing we'll talk about, because I suspect we're coming up on where we'll have to stop. I got strict orders. But I want to talk, because we've moved into some other, started with music, and we've moved into some other places to talk about visual art, to talk a little bit about martial arts. We haven't even talked about heart sounds. We haven't even talked about we haven't talked about herbs. We haven't talked about a lot of different things. But the thing that I want to end on here is asking you a little bit about integration, about the idea of the synthesis of things. And you said something once that my wife and I were visiting, Terry and I were visiting you, and you did heart sound recordings for us, and you said something that really impressed both of us. Terry reminds me of it from time to time, that you felt very strongly that you were an American artist, and that what that meant for you in terms of your music was that you could look around and choose the things that you wanted to use, and you could look critically at things from various different cultures and synthesize them openly and freely. And it feels to me like that's what you do in a more general way, that you're looking at ways of pulling all sorts of ideas together and putting them into some sort of practical application that will be helpful for humanity in the long run.
Right.
Does that seem right?
It is correct. Totally correct. If we look at the basic concept of what we're supposed to be doing, that they talk about America, and I'm going to be specific, I'm talking about right here in the so-called USA and these confines about what's supposed to happen. Because if we start talking about going into, you can say maybe Canada, I don't know too much about that, but maybe if we go down in South America, there may be still a problem because the way how things are set up. But being this is the United States and it's a kind of supposed to be unified situation going on here, I think sometimes people forget about what we're about. And I talk to a lot of people who want to concentrate on a continent, or they want to concentrate on areas within a continent. And then you get into all these divisions, you get into tribalism and all this and all that stuff. And I went through it, look, I'm a member of this cult or this religion. I'm not supposed to do this and I'm not supposed to do that. Well, you know, in the late 60s, when things wasn't looking just the greatest for me, I said, you know, I got all this publicity, and I said, well, you know, the finances, playing so-called free jazz and all that, is just not working. And I didn't want to become commercialized. So anyway, I said, if I had to get a day job, I want to do something I wanted to do. So that's when I went back, and I didn't want to go to any technology college, because I said, I don't know if I'm going to last 4 years. So I decided to go to a private lab school and study intensively for 1 year, and I studied medical laboratory techniques. And then I got my permit to work as a medical lab tech. But then I had the opportunity to work with a veterinarian before I went to Bennington for 2 years. And during this day, when I went to school, I met this guy who was running this international chemical company. He was selling the laboratory equipment. And we hit it off right from the get-go. He was much older than me. But he was Jewish, and he escaped out of Germany. And I would go to him and talk with him. And he would forget about science. And he started talking about the 30s, about the condition in Germany in the 30s for Jews there. And he said, we used to talk about, you know, all the bad things going to happen and happen and happen and happen to us. He said, many people just didn't want to believe it. And this guy, when he was talking, I could feel him because he was going deep down inside. He caught my attention. And he said to me, he said, you know, he talked about Einstein. He talked about a lot of those scientists that came out of there. He said, they would have never done in Europe what they did in America. He says, in America, we were free. And that really hit me. Really hit me. I said, you can walk this way, this way, this opportunity's there, that opportunity there. You just stop yourself. There's no system and no people. Nobody can say, you stop yourself. You see? And I tell young people, I said, you had no idea what this place was like in the 50s, in the 40s. I used to hear my parents talk about it in the 40s or different older people, how bad it was. And I just didn't pick it up. But in the 50s, you started seeing everything that was going on. And I used to hear people say, well, you know, you can't go to school because, you know, they don't allow you in, man, if you're African-American, and you see all these television programs. And I would get angry. I said, you know what? I said, they have a library. No computers, they have a library. And I said, nobody's going to stop me from reading. And then when you look back, and you see even Abraham Lincoln, if you want to use an example, or during those old days, people read. Books were very valuable. There's a lot of information in those books. So I would get everything I can find. Everything I could find. And I would read and I would read and I would read. And like, I became, you know, I was self-educated. So I wouldn't go around and fake no credentials. I just feel like I like to be the spokesperson for the person who didn't have the opportunity or was poor, who didn't get all this here. They're going to say, you can do it if you want to do it. I said, use me as an example. I said, I know shortcuts, how to cut this down and how to cut that down. And when I worked for Dr. Katz, you know, like he told me something one time. He said, you know what? Like I was an amazing story. He said, because I have 2 PhDs from Cornell. I have 2 masters and my bachelor's. And he was one of the hot vets on the scene. But I was a guy who was running the lab right on East 12th Street for him. He said, you know as much or more than I know about the laboratory. I showed him a manual one time that was outdated from the U.S. Air Force. It was a field manual. When you're working with animals, you don't take a vial of blood. You take drops of blood. And I had a manual that was out of print, you couldn't find, and I went to old books, a used bookstore, and I found the book. And I was developing these techniques. He said, how do you know this stuff? I said, I have an old manual from the U.S. Air Force. He said, can I get a copy of that? Well, I don't know. I picked that book. I can't find it no more. Because I realized, wait a minute, you done got all these papers, and I got something here. So I was getting jobs that, you know, I can't go no further because this is legal stuff. I was working the jobs, and I was the big chief, and didn't have all the so-called other credentials. That's why I said, you know, there's information out here. But you gotta want it. And you gotta work real, 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 real hard to get it. You see. So
that's a great inspirational place to stop for us today. That's a great place.
Thank you so much.
Questions and answers. We've already gone past that period, so we can do that privately. But I got a strict hour and a half limit for us. So thank you, Artist Institute. Thanks to everybody who made this possible. Thank you all for coming, being such a fantastic audience.